Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For the last decade and more, the deal has been this. China lends, the U.S. borrows, and China lends some more, billions more. Now, China's not so sure, but its cash is the ground we stand on. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner has just been in Beijing, working to reassure the Chinese. That, after Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao himself called for reassurance in March.
Of course, we are concerned about the safety of our assets. To be honest, I am a little worried. I call on the U.S. to honor its words, to stay a credible nation, and to ensure the safety of Chinese assets.
This hour on Point, America's banker and the future of the U.S.-China economic relationship. You can join the conversation. If you were China, would you keep lending? Does China have a choice? And what does it mean when the U.S. is the one saying, please? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We'll hear in a moment from two big China watchers, Li Jin at Harvard Business School and Brad Setzer at the Council on Foreign Relations. But joining us first from Beijing is James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine. He is one of the most plugged-in China watchers in American journalism and has spent years living and working in China. His latest book is Postcards from Tomorrow's Square, Reports from China. Jim Fallows, thanks very much for being here.
My pleasure, Tom. Good to talk to you.
It's great to be with you. So here comes Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner walking into Beijing, to the home of America's bankers, as we're kind of playfully calling them, but not so playfully. And the New York Times is reporting it's all soft and kind of deferential. Who's the boss here, Jim?
I think that just to talk about the atmospherics for a moment, I think that the trip was received in most of the Chinese press in a generally positive way for reasons not entirely connected to the economic relationship. For example, Timothy Geithner had been a student at Beijing University 20-plus years ago.
Yes.
They brought up pictures of him with his old Chinese language teacher, and he gave a speech that was seen as being relatively conciliatory in talking about the need for cooperation and each nation solving its adjustments. On the who's the boss front, I think the difficult situation is that each nation needs to adjust the way it's been running its business, and that adjustment is difficult for both of them, for China as well as for the U.S.
So maybe adjustment on both sides. Let's listen to a little bit of Geithner. Here he is in Beijing at Peking University yesterday talking about that codependent nature of the U.S.-China relationship.
A successful transition to a more balanced, stable global economy is going to require very substantial changes to economic policy and to financial regulation around the world. But some of the most important of those changes are going to have to come in China and in the United States. How successful we are in Washington and in Beijing will be critically important to the economic fortunes of the rest of the world. And the effectiveness of U.S. policies will depend in part on China's and the effectiveness of yours on ours.
Your point exactly, Jim, that everybody's going to need to shift a little bit here. Describe the shifts that are seen as necessary, and are they seen in the same way from either side of the Pacific?
Well, I think we all know about the shift on the U.S. side, where the crisis of the last 6 months has been a reminder, to put it mildly, of the need to have a better balance between consumption and savings. The Chinese have, of course, the reverse skew in their economy, and it is where there's been under-consumption domestically and overproduction and relying on the rest of the world, mainly the U.S., as a market for the goods, the excess goods China produces. The complication here, the contradiction from the Chinese point of view, is that simultaneously they would like to blame the U.S. in a moralistic way for living too high, for not tending to its business, for running up these big deficits, and also blame it for sort of victimizing China in cutting down its purchases of Chinese goods. And of course, the fact is, the very measures that are necessary for the U.S. to live in a more balanced way are going to reduce China's trade surplus. And so I think that's why the balance that is being called on from the Chinese system is to have more of its production consumed domestically, and that's not something that can be done instantly, just as the U.S. Readjustment can't be done overnight.
Jim, I'm looking here at the Washington Post, and their story out of Beijing today emphasizes that while China's leadership may have been welcoming to the U.S. Treasury Secretary, they're quoting lots of headlines here and comments in the Chinese press skeptical about the U.S. economy. From the Economic Information Daily here, part of the New China News Agency, headline demanding to know how, of the U.S., how do you propose implementing fiscal discipline? There are people quoting a new, it's an online survey, so who knows, but it's an online poll finding 87% of respondents believe that China's dollar-based dollar assets are unsafe. Is there a wide view?
The easiest way to analogize this is that over the last year plus, there's been a lot of anger among the Chinese populace at the sort of leaders of Chinese finance who have taken the country's hard-earned savings and invested them in, you know, Blackstone or whatever, where they've immediately halved in value. Mm-hmm. And if Americans in general were mad at their brokers and their 401k managers over the last year for this huge reduction in wealth, that's happened to China's holdings too, but it's easy to blame the foreigners for doing that. So I think the main source of the wrath is not so much some abstract indiscipline on the U.S. side, because that was fine as long as it was keeping China's exports markets going. But the fact that just as markets have plunged around the world, they plunge for China's holdings too, and there is an understandable sense of these New York tricksters are frittering away our money.
But at the same time, Geithner was very clear in promising to the Chinese or reassuring them that the U.S. would get its deficit spending in order once it's through the crisis. That wouldn't take forever, that they'd get the U.S. fiscal deficit down to 3% of GDP. I mean, this year it's supposed to be something like 12%. That's a big reduction. Jim, here's a little bit from Chinese state television. This is yesterday, after Geithner's speech. CCTV here interviewing Professor Hu Deming. He's a professor at Peking University, to get his analysis, and he went right at this promise of Geithner to reduce the U.S. deficit, an issue China's clearly worried about.
Can he deliver on his promises?
Well, let's keep our finger crossed. Simply because in this downturn, in this economic crisis, I think no one in the world knows how long the crisis is going to last. Now, if that happens, which means U.S. is going to put more funds or a rescue package to its domestic economy, then I think the fiscal deficit down to 3% of GDP is going to be very tough.
Jim Fallows in Beijing. There's skepticism right out of Peking University about Geithner's promise.
Indeed, and I'm looking at the article in the local paper here today saying that part of Geithner's speech was greeted by laughter by the audience at Peking University. And also they pointed out that the GM deal announced just about the time of the speech is only going to add to the deficit pressures. And again, I think the real concern and a complex one on the Chinese side is that in putting their money in the U.S. markets, which is from a rational point of view, the best place they can think of to put it now, if it looks like it's going to be an endless black hole, both because of the falling value of the dollar relative to the RMB and just other sorts of problems, that's the real concern.
A student asked Geithner after his speech about the basic, you know, sort of soundness of the economy. He had to be reassuring the student that the basic resilience and dynamism of the U.S. economy is there. Does China have the option, James, of doing something else, of not continuing to pump these billions into U.S. treasuries and elsewhere?
Well, I think there is a long-term option, which everybody, including the Chinese leadership, agrees would be better, which is to essentially balance its own production and consumption better, which is that China is producing some very huge percentage of its output, something like 40% or more, for the use of people in the rest of the world, including the U.S. And China is such a poor country with so many unmet needs. You know, there's open sewers, there are people who don't have heat. If it could be used domestically, that would be the better long-term alternative. In the short term, the options are putting into euros, putting into yen, doing letting the RMB float freely against the dollar, all of which have worse complications than putting it in dollars. So right at the moment, they don't have a very better alternative.
James, I have to ask you also, the timing of this trip was interesting, shall we say. This week, June 4th, is the 20th anniversary of the democracy famous outside China, not so famous inside China now, but democracy protest and ultimate massacre in Tiananmen Square. Was it strange of Geithner to come and just talk finance in a week like that? Was it deliberate on the part of the Chinese government to bring him in this week to maybe push aside contemplation of that anniversary?
You know, I guess it would have been more sort of in the world's face if it had been actually on June 4th, at which point I assume Guaitha will be out of the country if he's not already. But something which is really noticeable, and all foreigners are discussing it, is that this event has simply been airbrushed from collective knowledge in China. It is routine to encounter university audiences who have never heard of the events of Tiananmen Square 20 years ago, 20 years ago, 2 days from now.
And we're not hearing about it, as far as I could see, in Timothy Geithner's comments on the eve, practically, of that anniversary.
We're not, and I guess that was a calculation from his point of view that he was there to talk finance, and that would have been seen as if the Chinese finance minister, when going to talk about a bailout plan, was saying, "And boy, we really hate Guantanamo," or you know, "What about Abu Ghraib?"
I think I just about heard you say there, Jim, that we're not, the U.S. is not in a position to talk about that, all things considered.
I think the U.S. is in a position. I understand Geithner not doing it. I think that the U.S. collectively needs to be reminding people. I've been doing so on the Atlantic's website. Most journalists have. That this is a moment that the Chinese officialdom is doing everything it possibly can to suppress. I understand Geithner's not in a moment where he's doing economic business with China. Yeah, I understand it being not germane to what he was arguing.
But the U.S., a little bit in the supplicant role here as we talk about both economies changing. James Fallows in Beijing with the Atlantic Monthly. It's always great to speak with you. Thank you so much for joining us today, Jim.
My pleasure. Thanks, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about U.S. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner in China and what comes next for China, the banker, and the U.S., the borrower, in the U.S.-China relationship. We have two terrific China watchers with us this hour. Joining me in the studio is Li Jin, professor of finance at Harvard Business School. He grew up in China, taught at Fudan University in Shanghai, has consulted for Shanghai International Securities. He talks frequently with Chinese government officials and central bankers. He's just back from a trip to Beijing. Li Jin, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
And with us from New York is Brad Setzer, economist and fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's worked at both the U.S. Treasury Department and at the International Monetary Fund, writes a widely read blog about international finance called Follow the Money at CFR.org. He's written a report for the Council called Sovereign Wealth and Sovereign Power, the Strategic Consequences of American Indebtedness. Brad Setzer, great to have you with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Brad, first to you, if I may, what do you make of this moment and Tim Geithner's visit as you followed it in the last few days?
Well, I think it's crystallized in the popular perception, the fact that the U.S. is now a very large borrower and China is a very big creditor. And it's a reflection of the fact that, is, you know, you describe the relationship as a marriage, but I think it's a marriage where both parties are starting to wonder about the benefits that they're getting out of the marriage. The U.S. has borrowed an awful lot of money from China over the past 6 years. That binge of borrowing didn't end up all that well. We ended up with a financial crisis. And now China, and I think this is the biggest shift, at least the popular perception inside China has shifted, and the Chinese population is worried about the value of their U.S. holdings in a way that they weren't before. And that's, I think, a significant change, one that the leaders in both the U.S. and China are now trying to manage.
Li Jin, you're recently back from Beijing. You've talked with policymakers there. Is there a gap between Chinese popular perception of the United States and how good it is as an investment target for Chinese wealth now and the leadership? Is there a gap opening up between, you know, the top folks there and the rest of the country?
Well, I think so. The populist view there is that U.S. dollar is likely going to continue to depreciate against the Chinese RMB yen because of the need to inject more liquidity into the United States economic system to, you know, boost economic recovery. So there has been a growing concern within China about the safety of China's international investment. The government, I think, probably does still understand these concerns, but it probably has a higher priority of trying to maintain a smooth economic relationship with the United States, and also not being attributed as the factor that might undermine a speedier economic recovery in the United States and around the world. So it might take a different priority here.
So is there a point at which popular concern about the U.S. as an investment target in China pushes a change in Chinese policy? They've lost some on their treasury bonds already because of the shifts in the dollar. There are concerns globally in this country, too, about inflation. Inflation would hit the value of China's, trillion-plus dollar investment in the U.S. pretty hard.
Absolutely.
Is there a point at which China would say, no, we can't go on lending to you as we have, or does China really have no choice?
Well, let's first put this in perspective just a little bit. Mm. China's investment in the United States, or at least denominated in U.S. dollars, it's about one-third of its GDP. So that means that any 1% decrease of the value of the U.S. dollars against the Chinese yen would translate into about 0.3% reduction of the Chinese GDP.
And China's GDP this year is in what, 6%?
It's in the neighborhood of 4 to 4.5 trillion U.S. dollars.
Okay, so in other words, they could absorb that loss.
Well, China's GDP has been growing at about 10% so far. This year, they're expecting about 8% increase of the GDP. Mm-hmm. So, let's say if we're talking about a 10% reduction of the U.S. dollar value against the RMB, that's going to be a 3% decrease of the GDP just from the loss on the Chinese foreign investments in the United States. Mm. That would be a sizable loss compared to the GDP growth in China. So that is a big concern on paper, at least.
Okay.
Now, does that translate into a change of the Chinese policy towards investing in the United States? I doubt it. I think the Chinese government is more sophisticated and probably more sympathetic to the need of the United States to go through this very tough period of economic adjustment. And it doesn't want to simply pull the trigger and take away a large chunk of its own investment. And beyond that, as you and James both mentioned, there's probably no better alternative than investing in the United States.
Even if there are problems with that. Brett Setzer, we'll look at the longer term. But in this medium term or near term, when the world's trying to recover, U.S., China, both trying to recover former growth rates, do you see any danger of China pulling the plug on American borrowing, at least out of China?
I don't think that's an immediate risk. The problem that China faces is an inability to make a fundamental decision. Mm. China wants to peg to the U.S. dollar, and it wants to keep the Chinese currency undervalued against the dollar, at least in my view, in order to support its exports. Mm-hmm. That is always going to imply that at some point China was going to lose money. That's the nature of an export subsidy. You subsidize American borrowing so America buys more of your goods. And China wants to maintain the very tight peg with the renminbi to the dollar. And as long as China's maintaining that tight peg and as long as China's exporting more than it imports, it's going to be buying the financial assets from the rest of the world. And just given the size of China's surplus, it's hard to see how it cannot invest a large fraction of that in the United States.
But the view for a long time was that China would go on doing that because it had no choice. It had to keep pumping out those exports to create more jobs and more income for its very large population, a large part of which is not at all affluent, that politically it was sort of its hand, its arm was twisted behind its back here. It didn't have a choice. Do you see that as still the case, Brett?
I always thought China had a choice. I always thought China was actually making the wrong choice, that it should have allowed its currency to appreciate against the dollar, and it should have been investing a lot more at home, meeting some of those needs that Jim Fallows has signaled that indicated exist inside China. I never thought it made sense for a poor country to be financing a rich country and relying on demand from that rich country for growth. That said, China made a different choice. And I think that the difficulties of transitioning quickly away from an economy that's been based heavily on exports make it hard to change. But it fundamentally, it's a choice, and it's just a choice that so far China has always calculated that it had a stronger interest in supporting its exports than it had an interest in investing in the rest of the world in a way that assures that China will get a high return.
Brad Setzer, Li Jin, let's hear from our listeners. Let's take a call from Ithaca, New York, and Chris. Hi, Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
How are you today?
Okay, what do you see, Chris?
Well, I've been enjoying this, and the two issues that are themes that I'd like to pick up is sustainability and level of sophistication of Chinese foreign and economic policy. The first statement is this, that yes, it is sustainable, basically because work or labor in China doesn't have to be compensated for all the effort that creates the surplus, if you will. Now, the level of sophistication...
Yeah, I mean, they get paid, but you're saying that they're not paid what they might be.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. They do not have to be compensated for all that it's sold for.
Mm. Okay.
And therefore, they do have that surplus. Now, this surplus has historical references to 600 years ago. If you read the book 1421, the foreign and economic policy, trade policy of China was precisely to have accumulated debt from sultans and so forth to the west of China down the coast of Africa so that they would have access to the resources, the natural resources, but also control of the seaways. And so it is sustainable for the economic reason that I laid out. But what the Chinese real philosophical approach to trade and foreign policy is political capital, which operates with different equations, than monetary capital. And Fellows and the others were all talking as though they were rational in the sense of capitalist, money capitalist, and that there had to be a balance of trade, and that the artificial nature of the currency was not sustainable, when in reality it is.
And you think they're building political power with that as opposed to simply economic power?
Definitely, because when they invest in this country, and that was just comments, and oh, well, if the exchange rate changed, they would lose part of their investment, substantial investments. But you see their investment in ownership here of corporations or access to natural resources around the world.
And
is what they really are shooting for, not a return on the investment in a sense of capital, dry capital per se, but political capital.
And maybe in global power, let us look at that. Timothy Geithner spoke about that in a way at Peking University yesterday. He was talking about China playing a larger role in the international system. Let's hear.
As part of this process of reform, the United States will fully support having China play a role in the principal cooperative arrangements that help shape the international financial system, a role commensurate with China's importance in the global economy. I believe that a greater role for China is necessary for China. It's necessary for the effectiveness of these international institutions, and it's necessary for the world economy.
Li Jin, is that the U.S. Treasury Secretary kowtowing in Beijing? And what about our caller's points on sustainability of this relationship as it's been, and China's goals in taking on this foreign debt?
Well, I don't think the U.S. needs to kowtow in China. China needs the United States probably more than the United States needs China. At least they both understand they cannot be prosperous without the prosperity in the other country. So I think it's just a deeper realization and appreciation of the importance of China on the front of the U.S. Treasury officials. At the same time, I think the Chinese is probably not so complacent, I should say, about their new role as what we call the banker of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
They understand that they have their own problems, probably even bigger problems, and the economy development in China is very uneven. There's a huge population that is still very poor. So there's a long way for China to go in order to even keep pace with the development in the United States. And that is, I think, a clear picture, at least in the senior policymakers in China, if not perceived by the populist view. On the sustainability issue, I think I agree partly with the caller that the current edge of the Chinese export is a pretty low wage for some of the laborers. I think over time, as the Chinese population, a lot of these population were migrating from the rural area into the cities to join the industrialized economy. As they catch up, I think you will likely see an increase of the wages as people start to get used to more, you know, high-level consumptions and demand more. So the edge probably would go down, so the sustainability probably is not going to be that strong.
Let's get a call from Cleelon on I-35 in Missouri. Hi, Cleelon, you're on the air.
How are you today, Tom?
Pretty well. What do you see, sir?
Well, I'll be real honest with you. Fundamentally, you know, China and us were very different countries. We were based on different, you know, viewpoints on how our country are supposed to be run. We're extremely different. And so as far as China looking to us, you know, and investing money in us, I look at it in a basic fundamental thing. If I was a credit card holder, you know, and I'm going to the bank, you know, and I've already extended my credit, and I'm going to the bank and I'm wanting more credit. Well, they see that I've paid in the past, so they extend my credit a little bit, you know. So I go ahead and I make the payments and make the payments. Well, I see that I'm still in trouble, and I want to go back to this bank, and I want to go ahead and borrow more money. Well, eventually, they're going to come to a place and time where they're going to be worried about just exactly what China's worried about, is their assets and whether or not they can lend the money. The gentleman in China that was, you know, telling you that we needed to be at a 3% gross national product or whatever.
Our deficit, to get it down from 12 to 3.5,
okay.
Gettner said.
Yeah, but you know what? We're at 12%.
Mm-hmm.
Wishful thinking. This is wishful. We don't know when we'll get it down to 3%. I believe it'll happen, but we have no timeline, you know, on when this can happen. And so in their eyes, they are going to lose initially, you know, because of where we're at that, you know, in that. Mm. In that particular instance.
Cleelon, you put a lot on the table, and it's good. We'll get to all of it. Let me go right to the timeline issue, though, first here. Brad Setzer, you know, there are different agenda items, different priorities, different needs in these two countries. We heard the skepticism from the Chinese scholar about the U.S. getting anytime soon its deficit down to 3.5% of GDP. How do you see the timelines these two countries and economies are on? Can they be made to mesh up so that we can continue collaboratively in this dance through the crisis and beyond for some ways, Brad?
Well, I think there's a core question is whether we want to collaborate to maintain the existing relationship where China saves and lends and the U.S. Borrows and spends, or whether we want to collaborate so that we transition to a different relationship, one where the U.S. doesn't rely so heavily on China for financing and one where China doesn't rely so heavily on the U.S. as a market for its goods. And I think if you look at it in that way, you know, all the discussion up to this point is focused exclusively on the fiscal deficit. Mm-hmm. And the fiscal deficit clearly has gotten a lot bigger as a result of the crisis. But that increase in the fiscal deficit has come as households and firms have stopped borrowing. So the total amount that the U.S. borrows from the rest of the world, which is the trade deficit is the actual sum, has gone down. It was 6% a year ago. It's now 3%. And American households, which previously weren't saving, are now saving over 5% of their household income, which is a change which makes us a little bit less reliant here in the U.S. on Chinese financing. So there's sort of a perception that because the fiscal deficit has gone up, the U.S. is relying more on China for financing, when in reality, the trade deficit has gone down, and it's the trade deficit which determines the total amount that the U.S. borrows from the world. So I think we've made some progress towards a more balanced relationship. The challenge will be to keep that progress going after the recovery starts and the private sector starts to borrow.
So we don't go right back to the same old dynamic that got us in part in this pickle to begin with. Brad Setzer at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. Please stand by. Lee Jin of Harvard Business School with me in the studio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about U.S. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner in China and what comes next for China, the banker, and the U.S., the borrower, in the U.S.-China relationship. Brad Setzer is here, economist and fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, joins us from New York. With me in the studio, Li Jin, finance professor at Harvard Business School. Let's get a call from New Jersey, Creskill, New Jersey, and Mike. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Tom.
Hi.
Hi. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Just a kind of a statement and a question for Brad and James and the other colleague.
Li Jin.
Basically, the conspiracy that took place to kill manufacturing in the United States seems fairly deliberate. I think the U.S. populace is somewhat waking up to that, and you can see it in the downturn in spending, consumer spending, what's driven our economy. Just curious, the Chinese basically are trying to recapture a similar model, and I'm wondering how realistic that model is believed on the ground to be an avenue or a vehicle of growth.
To recapture what model, Mike?
Basically the consumer-driven economy that the U.S., I guess, unknowingly and unwittingly adopted for the past 30 years, seeing the shortfall this past fall, obviously with the market implosion.
Mm-hmm.
Just curious if the Chinese populace, with the crackdown on internet and whatnot, is aware and is as concerned of trying to replicate that model.
Let's pick it up. Li Jin, there's talk of this big shift. The U.S. has to borrow less, save more. China needs to spend more domestically.
Right.
Maybe in our caller Mike's view, he would see that as the call to become a consumer-driven economy.
Yes.
Can China actually do that?
Well, China, I think, is pretty firmly sold on the idea that over the longer run, the way to get out of the imbalance is for China to grow its own domestic consumption. That is a result of a continued discussion with the United States government, with the policymakers here, such as Hank Paulson when he came to China, repeatedly putting this message to China. So I think at this point, China is firmly sold on the idea that it needs to change its consumption pattern. It's not going to come easily in China, just as we know that in the United States, it's not so easy to decrease the consumption level. At least there are a few reasons why China doesn't necessarily going to see a quick, dramatic change in the consumption pattern. First, there's a huge amount of the Chinese savings that are precautionary because China still lacks the social safety net, the Medicare, the retirement pension system.
So people save for their own fates.
Absolutely.
As Americans are
exactly.
Now feeling like perhaps they must.
Right. And the second reason that I can see is that the lack of a credit, personal credit system. I talked to my colleague Peter Tofano at the Harvard Business School a lot about this issue. China at this point doesn't have a well-established personal credit system. So, for example, the younger generation who might otherwise want to spend a lot of money, they don't have the income to
even
support it.
Even if they wanted to.
Even
the
if they want
credit
to.
Card
right,
the system.
They don't have credit cards and so on and so forth. The third reason is that China has a very uneven economic development. While some areas, particularly the coastal cities, are very prosperous, a large part of the vast inland cities are very, or even the rural areas, are very poor. So again, there's a mismatch between the willingness to consume and the ability or the means to consume in China.
So, Brad, you said earlier that this, you're not sure this has been a particularly good marriage, the way it's been structured to begin with. You've said we need to rewrite the rules in this relationship and that is fraught with peril, that this is a dangerous time. We can't have this world with China lends and the U.S. spends. What's the peril? What's the danger? And how do we get out of it? How do we get through this transition, if that's what it's going to be, Brett?
Well, I think the peril and the danger is that as part of this transition, China has to finance a world. The U.S. is going to still be borrowing from China, but it's the borrowing that the U.S. is doing isn't generating the same kind of benefits for China. U.S. Isn't actually importing more from China now. China's exports aren't growing. So China isn't getting the benefits
the payback,
but it still needs to lend. And as part of this transition, China will have to recognize some of the losses on all the money that it already has lent to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
It was overpaying for U.S. assets to begin with. It was overpaying for dollars. And at some point, it will have to recognize the losses. So I think that the peril in that sense is that the politics may not allow China to gracefully accept the consequences of its past policy decision to keep an undervalued exchange rate. The U.S., the difficulty is that we have to accept a lower standard of living. We have to live within our means. The crisis has brought us some way there, but we still have a little bit further to go. And we're going to shift to a pattern of growth where our consumption grows at the same pace as our income. It doesn't grow faster than our income, and it might grow more slowly. And that's a little bit of a challenge. One quick point, though. China doesn't need to exactly emulate the U.S. model. The U.S. was consuming over 70% of its GDP. Mm-hmm. China now is consuming less than 40% of its GDP. There's a lot of room in between 40 and 70. So China doesn't have to go to a model where it overconsumes. It just has to go to consuming at a pace which is typical of most balanced economies around the world. So in that sense, I'm optimistic that that is a transition that is possible. The U.S. isn't asking China to take on enormous quantities of internal debt. The U.S. is asking China to consume at a pace commensurate with its growing income.
Nevertheless, so that sounds reasonable and possible, but you say that there's peril here, danger. How will we know if and when that sort of danger is hitting the wall, becoming manifest? What would we see?
Well, I think we're already seeing some signs of, I wouldn't want to overdramatize and say peril, but tension in the relationship. One core element of the relationship was that the China had to be willing to, the U.S. had to accept a shift in the composition of the U.S. economy where the U.S. was producing less, manufacturing less in the tradable sector to accommodate the growth in China's manufacturing surplus. But China had to accept that it would lend to the U.S. on terms that implied over time a very high probability of losses. It's a subsidy. A subsidy means you lose money on it. And right now you're seeing voices inside China questioning whether that subsidy is still in China's interest. So I think that's one sign of the difficulties associated with this transition. The question, though, is what's the alternative? And the alternative is just going back to the situation we had before the crisis where we were running a really big trade deficit. China was running a big, big surplus. Chinese exports were growing. U.S. imports were growing. The amount of money that China was lending to the U.S. every year was rising. And that doesn't strike me as a sustainable path either. So it's a difficult transition, one that is intrinsically fraught with peril. But it strikes me as less dangerous than a world where we in the U.S. rely so heavily on China for financing and where China relies so heavily on an over-indebted American consumer to be the market for its goods.
Now, the path ahead may not be so obvious here. Li Jin, you've noted that there is real fear of inflation in China because of what it would do to China's, in effect, investment in the United States.
Yes.
And that there are voices talking about moving Chinese money out of treasuries, and this is interesting, to the general stock market or even into real estate. Now, that is a lot of money. American investors, if they knew China was about to move into the stock market or into real estate, could get all excited about that.
Right.
Is that realistic, though? Because we have seen if China does that, then its stuff is really at risk. Those aren't treasury bonds on the U.S. stock market or in housing or anywhere else.
That's right.
Is that a real possibility? How big a movement there? Could that, send the Dow going woo over the moon again?
Well, I wouldn't rule out any possibility. As, Chinese always say, nothing is impossible. If you think about the alternatives, there are not a lot of alternatives elsewhere, like moving the money out of the United States or out of the U.S. dollar denominated assets. That's as the several callers and the previous the other guests pointed out, that's going to be politically very inappropriate, and China understands the danger of doing that. So they are not likely to move a lot of money out of the United States.
Not to Brazil or
exactly.
Right.
So within the United States, the way to diversify, it seems that there are only a few limited choices. So I would not be too surprised if China would be thinking about these alternatives. It's just a matter of time, when things like that might happen.
Well, interesting. Let's get a call from Detroit, Michigan. Eric, you're on the air.
Hey, how are you?
Okay, what do you see, Eric?
Okay, very interesting show. I was going to say a few things, but a couple of the callers before me took the words right out of my mouth. I'd just like to ask a simple question to your guests. Would you agree that the United States should stimulate growth through the consumer a little more? And then I'll hang up.
We got it, Eric. Thank you, Brad. Time to, you know, get the credit cards out again, stimulate consumer growth here, or do we have to do it another way?
Well, I think we don't want to go back to a world where American households were consistently borrowing to maintain a higher standard of living that was possible with their own income, their own wage income. That said, the consumer is the biggest force inside the U.S. economy. And if consumption continues to fall, it's very hard to see how a recovery in the U.S. gets going. So what I think you need to see a stabilization in consumption, a gradual rise, but a rise that is commensurate with the growth in wages, not a rise that exceeds the growth in wages. Mm. To just go back quickly to the point about equities, I think people don't realize quite that China actually did buy a fair amount of equities between the early 2007 and the middle of 2008. Mm-hmm. And the part of China's aggregate portfolio that has really lost money isn't the bond portfolio. Mm-hmm. It's the equity portfolio. So if you look at what China's actually doing with its money, it is shifting towards treasuries, not away from them. And it is buying very safe short-term treasuries, in part because of the losses it took when it took a lot more risk back in 2007 and early 2008.
And got stung. Let's get a call from Marblehead, Massachusetts, and Susan. Hi, Susan. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to point out that our economic position, America's economic position with China, puts us in a difficult position to comment on their human rights, both in Tibet and on the mainland. So, for example, when there was lead paint on Chinese toys, because we're using them as a plantation for low money, there was not a lot of press that I could find about how that lead paint was affecting workers in China.
And you think that that may be because the U.S. is sort of in the borrower position here?
Well, you don't bite the hand that feeds you. I think there's a lot other more complex issues with this, but I think this is one aspect, yes.
Susan, thanks for your call. Brad, do you see that happening here? We did not hear any kind of, dogging China by Timothy Geithner, at least that I'm aware of on this trip on human rights, et cetera. Is that the way it goes? The U.S. just not in a position to call China out?
Well, it's not really the job of the Treasury Secretary to make comments, which would typically be made by the Secretary of State or the President. So in that sense, I don't think it's unusual. But I do think that historically speaking, creditors have had more leverage than debtors, and that a world where the U.S. becomes an ever bigger debtor and China becomes an ever bigger creditor would make it more difficult for the U.S. to raise difficult political issues with China. And one way in which we're seeing this is the traditionally the membership of the G7 has been the seven largest economies, which all happen to be democracies.
Mm-hmm.
And implicitly, when we're accepting that China should be a full partner in all these institutions, we're accepting that the set of the world's largest economies is no longer all going to be a set of the world's largest democracies.
Mm-hmm.
And that implies that, in effect, we've concluded that the need for economic cooperation or at least dialogue with China is so great that you can't solve a whole host of economic problems, that you have to set aside questions about the composition of China's political regime. And that, to a degree, reflects the changes that have come with the very rapid growth of China combined with China's emergence as the world's largest creditor.
That's a pretty big accommodation all in itself. Li Jin, we had our caller earlier, Cleon, who was in Missouri, I think a big rig driver on I-35 out there, saying these are fundamentally different societies. And I had been reading in the Financial Times. Maybe Cleon reads it too. But here's Arthur Kroeber, who was just writing, on the American side, the reality remains that the U.S. is the leader of a global order grounded in the economic and political ideas of the European Enlightenment. Mm-hmm. China eagerly desires to participate in the benefits of that order, but its own polity is grounded in a totally different indigenous set of ideas.
Mm-hmm.
He says, bridging the gulf between European and Chinese notions of how national societies ought to be organized is an essential task for creation of a peaceful global society, but the gulf remains, he writes, and the U.S. and China remain on either side of it. So here comes China, not a democracy, into the G7 world, a big debt holder. Does it mean, in your view, that the world sort of political order shifts toward the Chinese way in the years ahead? Is that now inevitable?
Well, I think economically, China at this point is a totally different beast than the United States. It's far behind the United States in economic development. But in the pursuit of the market economy, I think I see China today as equally enthusiastic as anywhere else in the world. So on the economic front, I think China is probably as democratic as many of the other countries, although it does still have a pretty sizable state-owned sector, but that sector is diminishing over time in its importance. China tries to, you know, only try to take key control of some of the strategical sectors and then try to let go of the other sectors over time. It doesn't happen overnight, but it's going to...
We've just got a minute. These are huge questions.
Sorry.
But economic democracy, even if that were true, is not quite the same as political democracy.
In political,
it is not the same.
That's right. I do think China has a long way to go in the political, you know, side, and China is making some big effort. Here, I think the U.S. pressure would actually help China to, you know, to be moving towards the right direction.
But in this week of anniversary of Tiananmen, U.S. focus off in very different directions. Barack Obama will be in Cairo talking about the Islamic world on that day. And this relationship, with all of its fascinating complexities and its importance, rolls on. What a fascinating view of these economies, these countries, and this moment. I'm very grateful to both of you for being with us this hour. Li Jin, finance professor at Harvard Business School, thank you very much for joining us today.
It's a great pleasure.
And Brad Setzer, economist and fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, joining us from New York. Brad, thank you very much for being here.
It was a lot of fun.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thanks for joining us.